Right, so nice. I thought I'd talk about absorbing the mind. We all love absorbing our minds. What can be better than getting your nose stuck into a book, or taking on a jigsaw, or getting involved with a BBC TV drama over the weeks and just getting stuck into it and absorbed in it? Some people go in for slightly more adventurous ways of absorbing the mind. I was watching a program recently which featured a free climber. So that's somebody who climbs up sheer rock faces without the use of any ropes. And it was very interesting. He was asked why he did this. And he said, because when he was doing it, he felt peaceful. He felt at one with the world. At one with the world. That was his exact words. Isn't it interesting? Sounds so much like enlightenment, doesn't it? What's going on there? The mind is absorbing in what it's doing. It's losing its sense of itself. It's absorbing in something else, and therefore, at those times, we're not self-aware. We're not caught up in our worries and our troubles and our concerns. Because there's no self-view there at those times, there's no resistance to life. So one is just flowing, as it were, with life. May very well feel as though one is at one. And in terms of the free climber, you can understand that it's very unlikely that he's going to be sort of hanging by his fingertips and his toes off some sheer cliff face, feeling bored. It's very unlikely, isn't it? He's going to be absolutely, absolutely in the moment. Totally. So, the reason we love to absorb ourselves is because for the time being, we experience a kind of freedom, oneness with the world, peace, happiness, and that is an absence of self-view, an absence of resistance. The Buddha was well aware of this. He did talk about absorbing the mind into what he called jhanas. That's J-H-A-N-A. Jhana means that the mind is fixed, absorbed. You can reach really incredibly beautiful states of mind through mindfulness of breathing, for instance, which we practice here. We observe the breathing process and become absolutely entranced and enraptured, if that's a word, by that process, to the exclusion of absolutely everything else. And it is indeed blissful, peaceful. There is a sense of utter connection with the world, an absence of separation, an absence of concerns and worries. And the Buddha did say that it is a kind of freedom, freedom from absorbing the mind. So why is it then that state of absorption seems so hard to come by? Why is it that we just can't sit down, close our eyes, observe the breathing process as it occurs at the abdomen, become entranced and enraptured by the rise and fall of the breathing process, and enter into these wonderful deep states of peace and tranquility and freedom? Well, there are what we call hindrances, aptly named, because they get in the way. They stop that process from occurring. And the hindrances are the onset, the uprising, the occurring of self-concern, selfish preoccupation, worries, doubts, fears, anxieties, all the things that absorption is free from. So we find that we've got these two things. We've got the possibility of absorption, but we've got these things that hinder, that get in the way. Now, it is possible to learn how to absorb the mind, and it's well worth learning how to do it. But there are certain things we have to learn about and become aware of in order to accomplish this and become properly one-pointed and absorbed in a meditation. So we need to know about two lists of five things in each list. And although that might appear to be quite a lot to take in a half hour talk, I will try to make it as simple as I possibly can for you. On the one hand, you need to know about the hindrances. I'm sure you're quite aware of that there are five hindrances. There's sensual desire, ill will, slothful and torpor, what I'm calling laziness, worry and doubt. Sensual desire, ill will, laziness, worry and doubt. Those are what we call the five hindrances. And so they're the manifestation of this self-concern that comes up, which stops these absorbed states from occurring. There's another list of five that we need to know, which are called the jhana factors. Now, jhana is this state of fixity, of absorption of the mind onto its object. And there are five mental factors that the Buddha enumerated that go to make up any absorbed state of mind. Okay? And those are initial application of mind, sustained application of mind, pleasurable interest, happiness, and one-pointedness of mind. I'll just run that through again, although I'll be saying it lots of times. Initial application of mind, sustained application of mind, pleasurable interest, happiness, and one-pointedness of mind. Now, when we want to get into an absorbed state of mind, we have to develop those jhana factors. But we can't develop those jhana factors because they're being hindered by the five hindrances. So the five hindrances, essentially, self-concern, self-view, and all the neuroses that go on, suppress the ability for those five jhana factors to emerge, to grow, and become strong and mature. The question becomes, how do you absorb the mind? And the answer is, the best way to absorb the mind is to not try to absorb the mind. Because if you try to absorb the mind, you're ignoring the hindrances. And you can't ignore the hindrances. You have to learn how to deal with the hindrances. So the best way to absorb your mind is to actually practice mindful labelling, mindful noting of your experience. So when you sit down to meditate, you don't try to get concentrated. You sit down to meditate and you start mindfully noting your experience. You note any boredom that arises, any frustration, daydream, any irritation. You name it, whatever arises, you name it. And the important thing with this is, what happens when you properly label something and you allow for it, meaning that you let it be there. So let's take boredom as a for instance. What happens if you're in a meditation and you properly, accurately note and have clear comprehension that boredom is in the mind and you do absolutely nothing to correct it? You're no longer bored. Boredom is transient. Frustration is transient. Restlessness is transient. Whatever it is that we look at, if we're willing to just allow for it, let it be there, and not seek its opposite, not seek to get rid of it, just allow it to be there, you discover, you develop clear comprehension that it just disappears there and then. And that's critical to understanding how you get into an absorbed state of mind. Absorption is simply the absence of hindrances, simply the absence of any resistance. All, and I put that in inverted commas, all we have to do is learn to pay exquisite attention to what is present, observe it, and allow it to be, without any thought of wanting it to be different, without any thought of, but this is stopping me from getting concentrated, or any thoughts like that. You just allow it to be there, and you find that it passes away. Because there was no resistance to what was there, then it's easy for the jhana factors to start to emerge and grow. I'm just going to go through that again in a bit more detail for you by going through each jhana factor. And what we discover is that each jhana factor relates to one of the hindrances specifically. So there's this correlation between a jhana factor that leads to absorption and a hindrance which stops the absorption from occurring. The first jhana factor is called initial application of mind. Initial application of mind. Now that might seem like a pretty heady thing to get your head around. But what does it actually mean? We're all entirely familiar with initial application of mind. Whenever you engage in any kind of task, there is an initial application to that task, isn't there? If it is that you've got to move a boulder, you have to start by pushing it. You have to give it some initial application, which might be quite a bit of initial oomph to get it going, but you know once you get the boulder moving, then it's easier to actually keep it moving, isn't it? So you have that initial push. And you need that initial push when it comes to absorbing the mind in meditation. What is the hindrance that stands in the way of initial application of mind? It's laziness. We might call it initial resistance. When I was writing my book, for instance, seems a long time ago now, there we are. Every single time I approached the computer, it was with a... It's amazing, the other jobs I used to procrastinate, I all got done. Because I was procrastinating about doing this. And it is procrastination, is what we're talking about, is putting off what you had intended to do. So what I discovered was the best way was just to write anything, nonsense, and gradually you'd start to get into it and you'd overcome that initial resistance. Now think about meditation itself. Well, think about, you know, you get home from work and you think, oh, I haven't done my meditation today yet. And you experience that initial resistance, don't you? Okay. So, given the idea that I'm working on this evening, the most important thing here to do, is to mindfully note and label that initial resistance, that essentially that laziness. Note it as a resistance, but then allow it to be. Right there in that moment. We all have an innate intelligence. If we stop ignoring stuff and look at it directly, we gain not just mindfulness but clear comprehension. We actually see it for what it is. If you truly acknowledge what's there without wishing to get rid of it, it drops away. It drops away enough for you to then go, well, I'm going to go off and meditate anyway. I'm going to do it. See, because you've fully acknowledged the resistance and you haven't tried to get rid of it. If you try to get rid of it, you're increasing the resistance, aren't you? It's resistance squared. The most crucial thing in that situation is just to acknowledge and accept the resistance. All resistances require ignorance, ignoring for their fuel. If you don't give it that ignorance, if you look at it directly, it loses its power. Quite magical like that. So that's the most important thing. So it's true also in a meditation that we can have that same laziness. So this whole initial application of mind includes the way you set up the practice. Do you think about what you're going to do before you go to do it? Do you set up in proper intentions? Do you employ that little bit more energy in setting things up properly? That's what this push is all about. Also within the meditation, it can be that it all feels like so much hard work noting all this stuff. Noting, oh, God, such hard work. Oh, keeping the mind on, watching the breath, bringing it back to the breath again and again and again. And that's that resistance, it's that same resistance. And it's just employing that awareness, that mindfulness of just acknowledging that initial resistance, knowing that if you get the ball rolling, it will carry on rolling. You've just got to get over that initial resistance to practice. And so when we apply the mind to the breathing process, initial application of mind is when, you know, when how mindfulness falls away and get caught up with thinking, and you note the thinking and you bring the mind back, that initial application back to the breathing process. That can happen only because you're not resisting. Only because you've accepted that there's this initial resistance, and you relax into that, and then it becomes possible to return the mind to the breathing process. And you have to do that lots and lots and lots if you're going to absorb your mind. Moves away, you bring it back. That's that initial application of mind, bringing it back to the breathing process. Sustained application, jhana factor number two. Sustained application is like having got that boulder moving with that initial push, then it requires just gentle, repeated pushing to keep it going. So once you've started, sustained application keeps the process going, moving on. The hindrance that sits in opposition to sustained application of mind is doubt. People with lots of doubt with regard to meditation, Buddha's teaching, or self-doubt, their own ability to meditate, are the ones that tend to give up. Usually the people with a lot of sceptical doubt about the fruits of meditation who stop coming along. And they are always encouraged by their teacher to do more meditation, not less, to sustain their endeavour, not allow for what we might call sustained resistance, because that's what doubt has. It's like, I just can't believe that, I just can't believe that, I can't believe that. Now, we all know that the whole thing about this teaching is it's experience-led. It's that you find out from your own experience and gain confidence in what you're doing through the kind of evidence that you get from the practice. So that's what the doubter has to do. The doubter has to keep going, which means that they have to acknowledge their uncertainty. That's the thing that they have to acknowledge. The doubter is always seeking assurance, is always seeking, doesn't want to be duped, wants to know that they're on the right track and it's all going to be all right. If you become aware of those kinds of thoughts in meditation, doubting thoughts, you have to be prepared not to act upon them. You have to be willing to mindfully acknowledge, label the doubt as doubt, and then not seek a solution for the doubt, but just rest in the uncertainty. And for someone with a lot of doubt, of course, that's not easy. But if you do, you find that those doubtful thoughts will drop away, because that's the nature of all things, to arise and pass away. It's through acknowledging that you can't resolve the doubts by entering into a course of practice under guidance and sticking to the guidance that over time you start to get real, genuine evidence of what that brings, and then you gain the confidence. It's through accepting that the doubt is there, acknowledging the doubt, but not seeking a resolution, the doubt falls away, and that allows a sustained application in whatever direction that you're intending to go. Okay, the third jhana factor is pleasurable interest, what we call PT, which is kind of says it all, really. Pleasurable interest means taking an interest in the object, whatever the object happens to be. The hindrance that stands in the way of pleasurable interest arising is ill will, irritation, aversion, and in meditative terms, boredom. One of the reasons that the Buddha encouraged people to practice loving kindness was that it overcomes aversion and irritation and ill will. Because when you practice loving kindness, you specifically take an interest in somebody else. You think about their good qualities and wish them well. When the mind is interested, it doesn't want to be anywhere else. It just is happy to sit with what is. So, in meditation, if we use the example of boredom, as I was talking about earlier, it's not that we try to seek out pleasurable interest in the object necessarily. The most important thing is to mindfully label boredom and allow that boredom to be there. And if you allow that boredom to be there, if you note boredom as boredom, are you bored? The discovery is that there is this delightful zest that arises the moment you accurately label boredom as boredom. You go, oh, that's boredom. There is this interest that immediately arises. And it's the same with anything that you label in meditation. If you really truly allow it, let it be, irrespective of what it is, and you go, oh, that's that, there is this wonderful fascination and interest that develops. So again, don't try to get interested. Just be happy to be bored. Just be happy to be with what the truth of that moment in the meditation. And you'll find that that boredom just simply drops away. And in its absence, that pleasurable interest, that lovely zesty interest in what's going on develops. It's really lovely. The fourth jhana factor is happiness. And the happiness that arises as a jhana factor is the most delightful, delightful. You know the word dukkha, meaning suffering? Well, there's a Pali word sukha, which means happiness. And it's like this sukha that arises in meditation, and it seems to come from down here in the abdomen, and it just rises almost like a light, just filling the whole of the mind and the body with this delightful happiness. But what suppresses that and gets in the way of that is worry and anxiety, which is a common enough hindrance for people. Worry, which is obviously always trying to fix problems, creating problems often to then try to fix them, obsessing the mind, and there's no chance of that happiness arising. What is it that you do? You don't try to get happy. You don't try to get rid of the worry or the anxiety. You learn to rest with the worry, to rest with the anxiety, to label it clearly that this is indeed, the truth of this moment is worry or anxiety, and you don't seek its opposite. I'm not saying you should just, next meditation, you should get all this perfect or anything like that. I mean, this is why it's a training, obviously. But the point is, you learn to just rest and not resist the worry. Yes, it's painful. Yes, it's unpleasant. And there will be a strong urge to go back and play with it again and again, whatever it is. And you learn over time, just acknowledge it each time and just rest with that sense of insecurity, of these problems being outstanding and none of them are fixed. But when you clearly, mindfully acknowledge the worry and you just rest with it, you allow for it, as the truth of this moment, it falls away. Because you're not feeding it. You're not feeding it with resistance. You're not ignoring it. Okay. And that allows that happiness to just blossom. I mean, this morning's meditations. I mean, I shouldn't tell you about my meditations, but as you can understand, I mean, if I'm doing a talk in the evening, what do you think of my meditations? Oh, I could say this, oh, I could say that. And it takes quite a lot to go, no, come back, no, come back. And you wouldn't say, there isn't much happiness there at that time, but each time you do it, and you have to be very patient, and you're just very allowing, and each time you bring the mind back and come back to the breathing process, each time you do it, it just weakens and weakens and weakens that tendency until finally the mind just stays put. And that lovely happiness is free to arise. Okay, the last of the five jhana factors is one-pointedness of mind. So that's focus. And we're looking at the breathing process. Having gone from perhaps a wide awareness, bringing it down to just the abdomen and looking at the rise and fall of the abdomen, and then perhaps going in even further and looking at one area of the rise and fall of the abdomen, and just forever fixing and focusing the attention in one spot. So what do we think the hindrance that suppresses that ability is? It's sensual desire, the last of the five hindrances. Sensual desire is a very active component of mind. It's like a bee going from flower to flower to flower, endlessly trying to find its little bit of honey, little bit of honey, little bit of honey. The mind is always trying to go out and find pleasure. But pleasure is a very illusory thing. It's a very illusory feeling. It lasts for a moment and then disappears. Like, oh, I think about that. And you think about that and it gives you a pleasure hit and then it's gone. And then you have to think about it again. And then you have to think about it again. And what that leads to is a habit of mind to just wander, to be easily distracted, to go from here to here to here to here. And that's the very opposite of focus, isn't it? Dissipated energy. One-pointedness of mind is non-distraction. So it's able to remain in an area and focus in on that area. So, again, with essential desire, what I found with sensual desire is that you have to go through this process of bringing the mind back again and again and again and again. It wants to go for its little bit of honey, and you bring it back again. A little bit of honey, no, bring it back. A little bit of honey, no, bring it back. What emerges is actually frustration, because the mind was so habituated to getting its little bit of pleasure here and there, isn't being allowed to, and it doesn't like it, so the mind gets very frustrated. That's frustration in meditation is a sign of success. You're succeeding with your restraint. It's a good thing. So you sit there with the frustration. You allow the frustration. What you find is if you're able to label the sensual desire and the frustration, you find that the frustration falls away. The tendency to... You grow in wisdom and you recognise the futility of that journey to that flower. It doesn't get honey, does it? That's ridiculous. Bee doesn't go to the flower to get honey. But you know what I mean. The pollen. It's the pollen, isn't it? But you know what I mean. Yeah. But the mind starts to recognise how ridiculous that is, and you grow in wisdom enough that the thought, oh, shall I? And you go, oh. So you just generally... the mind starts to acknowledge that it prefers just to be stationary, to rest, to be focused. It can be quite a journey, that one, I know from experience. All of this, then, is not focusing on developing the jhana factors themselves. Rather, it is about dealing with the hindrances, dealing with those unwanted states, observing them, allowing them to be, and letting them go. Each time we do that, of course, what we do is we bring the mind back to the breathing process. We do that. There is that initial application of mind. There is that sustained application of mind. And we do take an interest in the breathing, and that does generate happiness and one-pointedness of mind. But of course, there is this to and fro, hindrances arising, dealing with them, letting them go, coming back to the breathing process. But can you see that the emphasis is on the mindful observation of experience without wanting it to be different, because you don't create the resistances. And in the absence of resistance, those jhana factors gently develop. And it reaches a point gradually when the jhana factors become stronger than the hindrances. When initial sustained application of mind, pleasurable interest, happiness, one-pointedness of mind begin to merge and fuse. They begin to support each other. And the mind, being free of hindrances more of the time, begins to just sink delightfully into observing the breathing process. Because there's no resistance, there's no trying. At this point, there's no trying to get concentrated at all. It's just the natural outcome of being free of hindrances, being free of resistances, but being interested in the breathing process. And it can become utterly sublime. Utterly sublime. That happiness emerges from the depths of somewhere you don't really know where it is. It just takes over the whole body. And there's this delightful, pleasurable interest which is just flowing around the body and the mind. And because there's so much interest and happiness, you don't want to be anywhere else in the world. You literally think, why don't I just do this all day? And there is this, like, there's simply the observation of the breathing process, and you're just with the breathing process, and there's total interest there. There's effortless initial and sustained application, because there's nothing getting in the way. There's nothing, you know, there are no hindrances. It's just this delightful observation going on. And it becomes so interesting that you're just not interested in anything else. So you cease to be aware of sounds. You cease to be aware of the room that you're sitting in. You cease to be aware even that you're meditating. And you know you're getting concentrated when you're no longer aware that you're meditating. Makes it a bit difficult when you're taking the meditation. So it's absolutely delightful. And at that time there is absolutely no self-concern. There's no neurosis. It's peaceful. It's absolutely delightful. And it's no wonder that the Buddha did call the absorption of the mind a freedom for the time being. It is a wonderful freedom. So those are the two sets of five, the five jhana factors: initial, sustained, pleasurable interest, happiness, and one-pointedness of mind. And opposite them are the hindrances: sensual desire, ill will, laziness, worry, and doubt. The important thing to remember about absorbing in that way is that it is temporary. You do reach the point where the jhana factors are stronger than the hindrances, and we talk about that kind of concentration. They talk about it being neighbourhood concentration, meaning that it's still in the neighbourhood of the hindrances. The hindrances are close by, but for the moment they're temporarily suppressed. So it's like anything. It's like if you put carpet over weeds, the weeds won't grow, but if you take the carpet up again, the weeds are still underneath and the possibilities for them to grow again. Some people get confused with concentration, believing that concentration equals enlightenment. You get into these amazingly deep states, and when you talk about them, the similarities are definitely there. It's, you know, there's this wonderful sense of oneness. It's sublime, it's peaceful. All sounds like the sort of thing we want enlightenment to be. But it's important to recognise that concentrated states are not enlightenment. They are concentrated states. It is the experience of peace, which is lovely. But all such states are transient. So what the intelligent meditator does is that they acknowledge that all such concentrated states can't be total freedom. It requires work, and a lot of mindful work, in order to create these lovely absorbed states of mind and to get them to continue. And if you ever stop working at them, they will start to deteriorate. They can't therefore be relied upon. So what the intelligent meditator does is, if they are getting into deep states of concentration, they are, to whatever kind of incredible meditative states that arise, they apply to them the three characteristics. They observe the fact that the peace, the tranquility, the rapture, the zest, all those beautiful states are transient. They therefore are, in the ultimate sense, unsatisfactory, ungraspable ultimately, uncontrollable ultimately, and are not self. So they're transient, they're unsatisfactory, and they're not self. Doesn't mean they're not enjoyable, but because they're transient, they are ultimately unsatisfactory. Because the mind is so delightfully concentrated, the observation that these incredibly pleasant states are ultimately unsatisfactory creates this really deep insight into the true nature of reality. And it means that the meditator avoids developing attachments to those deep, calm states. Being free of attachment to those deep, calm states doesn't mean you can't enjoy them, but what it does mean is that you don't have any expectation with regard to them. You understand that ultimately grasping onto them and having a dependency upon them is only going to create more suffering. So the meditator learns to let pleasant states go. They learn to let peace go. They learn to let tranquility go. They learn to let deep equanimity go, rapture go, because they recognize that any attachment to them will cause suffering. As a consequence, they become truly mature meditators, and they come to know the difference between a peaceful experience and the peace that comes from understanding. We practice here insight meditation, primarily, because we know that a peaceful experience is just that. It will arrive, it will pass away. But there is a peace that comes from understanding, a transcendent understanding that comes from the knowledge that all possible states have the nature to arise and pass away, which leads to a complete abandonment, a complete letting go, a complete non-dependency upon anything in the world. And you discover that that is true peace. That really is true peace, because you're not dependent on anything. Nothing can ever let you down, not even a deep state of concentration.